Water, water, everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water, everywhere, nor any drop to drink. Welcome to the Troubadour Channel. Today, I'm going to be reading a special attempt at a reading of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now, before I read it, I want to accomplish two things to the best of my ability. One, I want to make a case for why you should spend the time studying and reading poems like this and this poem in particular. And two, I want to give you a summary of the poem. So when you read these poems, often, this is a more epic poem. It took me about 45 minutes to read it. So in the podcast, you'll notice it's a little bit of a longer podcast, and that's because there's an intro, there's the reading of it, of the poem, and then there is a brief little, or some kind of discussion at the end. I want to give you a little context and influence of this poem. So there's a lot going on in this podcast. I understand it's longer than normal. You know, I hope you'll break it up if you need to, or listen to it on a long ride or drive. I also want to start by saying that my reading of it is my best attempt at this point to read it. If you go to troubadourmag.com, that's TROUBADOUR mag.com, I will embed a video of Ian McKellen reading this poem. And to say that it is better than mine is, you know, if I'm being honest, it's like the 3-year-old's drawing of a landscape versus a grandmaster landscape artist, the greatest landscape artist in history type landscape artist. Not to say he's the greatest reader in history, but it's probably the greatest reading of this poem that we have recorded that I know of. It's an amazing reading. He does such a great job. You know, I don't want to lie to you and say, oh, you should spend 40 minutes on mine and not his is a little shorter, partly because there's two reasons his is shorter. His is 30 minutes. One, he reads the 1798 version. I'm reading Coleridge's official 1817 version, his supposedly final version, or one of the final versions. Wordsworth, or not as bad as Wordsworth, but he also would tinker a little bit and change things. And there are some changes you might notice if you listen to both or read both. But I also chose it because I tried something daring that most teachers don't do, and I think most poetry teachers wouldn't do, and there's a good reason for it, but I wanted to try it nonetheless. And that is, I read alongside the poem itself. I read the little inscriptions, descriptions that Coleridge added to the later version of this. So, you know, for instance, I read Water, Water Everywhere just at the opening of this. Before that, if you're listening to my version, you will hear me say, I tried my best to do a slightly different tone of voice, but it would go like this. And the albatross begins to be avenged. Water, water, everywhere. And all the boards did shrink. Water, water, everywhere. Nor any drop to drink. So I first read the description, and then I read the poem. And sometimes, so if you look at an actual version of this in print, it'll be the description, Coleridge's prose description of that stanza and the following stanzas, if it's relevant, and then the poem immediately to the right. So it's like a little inscription right next to it. So just to give you another example, you know, I'll be reading, I'll read the poem. It'll be, "'Twas right and set, they set, 'twas right, said they, such birds to slay that bring the fog and mist." The fair breeze continues. The ship enters the Pacific Ocean and sails northward, even till it reaches the line. The fair breeze blew. The white foam flew. The furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. Okay, so I hope that is a sufficient, you know, tonal change. Although I'm not a, you know, talented actor, so I don't even know if I'm capable of doing that consistently. That's one of the things a good actor is good at, is consistently keeping up the meter, the rhyme. That is interrupting the meter and the rhyme, what I'm doing. So it's a, you know, but I took the challenge because I hoped that it would help you with the scaffolding of the story. So you'd understand what was going on significantly enough or sufficiently enough that it would hold your interest. Now, if I'm wrong, you know, please let me know. Maybe I'll just do a straight reading in the future so you can have one of me reading it if you are interested. But I really want people to have an understanding of the poem so that they're not lost, so that you can try to enjoy some of the, that you can enjoy the language as much as possible. Now, the best way to enjoy the language is by reading it yourself or by, you know, hearing a straight reading. But again, if this is assuming this is your first real hearing of this tale, and I wanted you to have a description of the story, because it is a ballad form, or it's a story. This is the first poem in the 1798 Lyrical Ballads. So before I go into that, I want to give you a quick case for why you should spend some time on this poem and on poems like this. And then I want to give you a summary of the story in the poem that'll, you know, and I want to give you the whole thing. I might hold off, or I'll hold off a little bit on the exactly the very, very ending. So you'll have to wait and see what happens to the wedding guest and the mariner. But I'll give you a general summary of everything else. Okay, so one of the things in the ways that I have been taught poetry from objectivists and from people within that community that has really, really helped is the idea of trying to make the literature, the artwork, personal to you. So trying to find some stories in your life that can bring out and the relevance of the theme or the characters or something in the story to make it personal so that you like the story because you like the story and you make a connection. Now, I do think that that's very important and helpful, especially when building a first enjoyment of poem or poetry in literature. But I would say it's not a sufficient reason to read. And it's not. So one of the reasons I think objectivists, who are arc individualists, say that particular phrase of make it personal, that I do, again, I want to say that I do agree with that. But what they are advocating against and what they are trying to fight against, I think, is this classicism, this duty-bound reason to read something. Right? So it used to be common, you know, the canon of in medieval time of the Bible was the canon, and everybody had to read it. It was a duty to read it and even memorize passages or whole sections or the whole book, the whole Bible, for goodness sake. And you know, so there, this kind of having to memorize and to force down the throats of all students or all educated men, that idea is something that I do think is a problem to force down and to say, read this because I say so in an authoritarian way. But the reaction of only, you know, because the danger, I think, of the objectivist way of looking at it, where you have to find things that, you know, it's personal to you. And I've seen this in the way that the schools, you know, sometimes will teach this to children. The danger of that is that you're only going to look for those aspects that are personal to you, and you're going to miss the broader purpose of what the poet, the literary writer, the author is trying to accomplish. And that is wrong. You shouldn't do that. The best way to read is to try to gain the totality of what the author is accomplishing or attempting to accomplish, and to see if you like it. And then you can have, if there is a personal connection, make the personal connection. So you have to kind of read it just to enjoy the story, the in a poem, the meter, the sound of it, the pleasure of the sound. So for instance, I don't agree with the philosophy of this poem I'm going to read, but the sound is beautiful. And it's a haunting tale that resonates and that sticks in your mind when you hear those kind of, the rhythms that I was just reading. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. By thy long gray beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stoppest thou me? So there's, there's something very resonant in that tone and in the way that that sound. Now, the main argument I would make, so I wanted to set that up because I know a lot of people are possibly coming to the, I've said this on the show many times of making it personal, and I do agree with that. But there is a broader reason to read it. And I want to express something that I heard from Dr. Ankar Gatte, who is a former teacher of mine. He's an objectivist professor. He teaches at the Objectivist Academic Center through the Ayn Rand Institute. So he teaches philosophy, and he teaches objectivist philosophy. And at a recent conference, he said something along the lines of, there are works that will give to you the feeling that Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead gave to you, probably. So if you like The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand, which I assume many of you probably do, and if you don't, let me know. That's fine. Let me know what artwork did make that feeling, does make a strong impact on you, that was inspirational, that resonated with you, that uplifted you in some way. But Ankar was making an argument for why objectivists should stop rereading The Fountainhead. And Dr. Leonard Peikoff, who is Ayn Rand's intellectual heir, made a similar argument. I make this argument as well, learned from them, that, there are works that will give to you the feeling that the Fountainhead will give to you, or does give to many of you. But one thing that I would add, so he's basically claiming that there are artworks out there and you should go explore them. And I agree. But one thing I would add that I don't think is touched on enough is one difficult roadblock, barrier of accomplishing that emotional connection to another artwork is lack of taste, lack of experience. And I think there is a view that either something that I have expostulated, and I've heard many places too, that, if you read something and you don't quite get it, or if it doesn't resonate, or you're not feeling it, that, just move on. It's okay. It's not the right thing for you. It's just not hitting you in the right way. And it's up to the artist to do that. I have come to disagree with that fundamental statement. I believe it's, an artist should try to resonate with an audience, but there are some great works of art that are master craftsmen, aware of the literary, for instance, in the literature, but this is true also of music, where they're not making music in a vacuum. They are aware of the centuries of musical developments, the different instruments, how they all work, and so on and so forth, that they can add to that, history and add something radically new, but based on what they've learned from that tradition. And then there's something similar with literature, where there's thousands of years of writing down our stories from Gilgamesh and Homer's The Iliad and Odyssey on down to modern time. And there are some writers, like a Coleridge, like a Wordsworth, like a Hugo, like a Rostand, like a Goethe. There's many writers that are extremely aware of this. And they are writing, you know, something new, but it's still within the tradition of the language and the way the language is used, and they're masters of that. And it's on you, the reader, to develop the taste sufficient enough to grasp and to be affected. So another example, of course, if you've ever developed a taste for wine, you know what I mean, on your taste buds. If you've developed a taste for, the concept of developing a taste is a real concept. And with literature, the taste that you're developing is the use of your mind, because language is the language of consciousness. The word consciousness means conscience, with knowledge, or to know. So it's to know with. So what are you knowing with? Well, the thing you know with is words, our words, language. And so the greatest art is literature, because of that purpose, is that, you know, all music can expand, you know, it's said that it expands your consciousness. And I think it probably does. I know nothing about music. And my experiences of classical music is that it does do something magical to you. It evokes the emotions directly in a way that no other art does. I think it's clear that paintings are, of course, visual, and they can do something to train the way that you look at the world around you. And they also temper your consciousness. I mean, I think all art works with your consciousness, but I believe that, ideas, the way we look and interact with the world is primarily through words, and literature is the word. It's the word that we are focused on. And so this is something that really takes time to develop. So that's my main argument for why you should read great literature and poetry. And to add on to that, you know, the purpose of doing that, it's not to develop taste for the sake of developing taste. But the purpose of doing that is to develop taste so that you can have profound artistic experiences. So in other words, it's akin to, there's some crude analogies that I always give to people. And, you know, just imagine somebody who, you know, only self-pleasures themselves their whole life, versus having sex. And that is the profound, I try to make it clear that it is such a profound experience that you cannot convey it completely in words. You have to, my words right now, arguing for it in prose explanation is insufficient to do what needs to be done. Only poetry and literature itself can do it. Only the great poets can really make that impact on you. But it won't happen automatically. That's the assumption I think we often make, is, just kind of read stuff, and if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. You got to work at it. Just like you got to work out. You're not going to have a great mind just by, osmosis. You're going to have a great mind if you challenge yourself and work through difficult readings like The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and many others like it. Now, just to throw off a couple other examples. I mean, it's like, in terms of analogies of taste being something that is a profound shift once you've developed it. I mean, it's like the difference of you're eating gruel, prison oatmeal, with water and some oats thrown into a dirty bowl. That's what you're eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner your whole life. And then all of a sudden you're starting to eat filet mignon and things of that nature. Now, at first it may not even taste that good to you. You may not even appreciate it, but eventually you'll start to appreciate it. Like a barbarian at first who's been raised in captivity or something, eating gruel only, all of a sudden starts to eat filet mignon. He'll probably just just garble right into it and not really understand how to savor, right? But really, that's not even a profound enough of a shift that I think reading great literature and understanding it will do for you if you put in the work. And I'm saying that as a will. I guarantee it will if you put in the work. And the way, you know, the better analogy is it's more like having gruel your whole life from birth until death versus ambrosia, eating ambrosia, the food of the gods. Now, this is the thing that made them immortal. But, you know, in a sense, it's like this special kind of food that's not even accessible to most people. And that's what, you know, reading and experiencing great art is like. And so that, you know, so the idea of it's a two-pronged argument. You need to develop the taste, not because it's personal. So, you know, even if a poem or a story doesn't resonate personally with you, that's no reason not to read it, because another reason is you can work through it to develop taste, which is a personal thing for you, to develop your taste for great art. And then second, when you've developed your great personal taste, you will experience grand art more grandly. So it's the fountainhead argument that Ankar was making, is that there are artworks out there that can impact you in the same way that the fountainhead or whatever has impacted you profoundly can. But sometimes, or I would say all the time, they will require a good amount of development in yourself first. Now, I'm going to, so that I hope, you know, I know that was a bit long, but this is going to be a long episode in general. I hope that that gives you a little bit of a reason to work through this, to think of it as, you know, I want you to just kind of sit back and listen to the poem, but I also want you to go to troubadourmag.com, read the poem, buy the poem itself, you know, or print it out, read it a couple of times, really try to understand the story and experience the poem. And this is what I've been trying to do with lyrical ballads. So after I read the poem, I'm going to go into a little bit of the origins of this poem, you know, where, what it did for romanticism, what its impact on literature was. It had a profound impact. It is a kind of a horror story, so I'm trying to release this on Halloween for that reason, although I'm sure most of you are too busy to listen to it on Halloween, but it's a bit of a horror story. And in fact, the young Mary Shelley, when she first heard this poem, hid behind a chair. And that, you know, I just want you to think about that for my argument for why you should read poetry and literature, is that for her, when you read this, I highly doubt it's going to scare you. Didn't do it to me. But for her, she was able to sit inside the story so clearly. It was so real to her because her taste was so well developed that for her, it was terrifying. She could see everything. She could hear everything. She knew the creaks and the terrors and the atrocities that occurred. And, you know, when she saw the men reanimate, there was something real of that. And she could visualize herself as the mariner on this boat with these dead men, and they're going through the ocean. I mean, this was a profoundly impactful story on the people who read it, the people who had taste. Now, if you don't, I don't mean to insult you. I can tell you I didn't either. But it takes work. And once it happens, you can really feel something profound occurring in you. All right. So here is a brief summary of the story. Like I said, I want you to have a general idea of what's going on. So the poem begins and it introduces an ancient mariner who has this glittering eye, and he stops a wedding guest. So I'm going to be going to a wedding in a couple months with my best friend. And I think about this. So if you've ever been to a wedding, this is one of those times to try to make it personal and just think of yourself as walking into, this wedding with all your friends, and this old man, this maybe stinky old sailor, stops you. And the glittering eye of the ancient mariner stops this wedding guest from entering the wedding celebration. And he stops him in order to tell him the story of his ship. And he provides no introduction, but simply he begins his tale. He doesn't say who I am as an ancient mariner. He just starts telling him about, hey, I was on this ship. And despite the wedding guest's efforts to leave, the mariner continues to speak. The mariner's story begins with the ship leaving harbor and sailing southward. And there's a tremendous storm that blows the ship even further to basically the South Pole, where the crew, they're put in awe as they encounter mist and snow and cold and giant glaciers. And basically they're ice everywhere. And they're entrapped by ice. And then all of a sudden, an albatross breaks the pristine lifelessness of the Antarctic. And the sailors are able to, you know, they look at it as this albatross, the seabird, as a good omen. And a new wind kind of rises up, propelling the ship. And day after day, the albatross appearing in the morning when the sailors call for it and soaring behind the ship. But then, just then, as the other sailors cry out in dismay, the ancient mariner, the man who's telling the story, for reasons unexplained, shoots and kills the albatross with his crossbow. At first, now the other sailors are, of course, furious with the mariner for killing this bird, which they believed a good omen, and responsible for making the breezes blow. But after the bird has been killed, the fog clears, and the fair breeze continues, blowing the ship north into the Pacific. And the crew comes to believe the bird was the source of the god and mist, and that the killing is justified. So their superstition makes them think that, okay, he killed it, and now the thing's... So maybe actually when we saw the bird come to us, you know, it came out of the fog. Maybe it was of the fog. Maybe it brought the fog, and killing it was a good thing. So, you know, it's then that the wind ceases, the ship becomes trapped on a vast, calm sea, and the sailors and the mariner become increasingly thirsty. Water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. And some sailors dream that an angered spirit has followed them from the pole. The crew then hangs the albatross around the mariner's neck. So in the story, there's a kind of a flip-flopping of the, you know, meaning of the albatross according to the sailors. At first, it's a good omen, and then it's an evil omen, and then it's a bad omen again. And then they link it, you know, in a cross, it's analogized to, around the neck of the mariner who shot it. The ancient mariner, the teller of this whole story. Now, in this terrible calm, trapped completely by the watery ocean that they cannot drink, the men on the ship grow so thirsty that they cannot even speak. They're, you know, if you've ever had a parched throat, you know what that's like. When the mariner sees what he believes is a ship approaching, and he, in order to get their attention, because there's nothing to drink, he has to bite his arm and drink his own blood so that he is able to alert the crew, who all grin out of joy. So he bites his, you know, he alerts the crew and says, hey, there's a ship. But to tell them, he bites his arm, sucks the blood. But the joy of seeing the ship fades as the ghostly ship, which sails without wind, approaches. And on its deck, they can see death and another spirit called life in death. So there's the, you know, envision the spirit death with his, you know, hood, his cowl, and his scythe. And then another spirit that's life in death, a kind of Casper ghost type thing. And they're gambling with dice for the lives of the sailor and the mariner. After life in death wins the soul of the mariner, the sailors, all the men on the ship begin to die of thirst, falling to the deck one by one, each staring at the mariner in reproach. Surrounded by the dead sailors and cursed continuously by their gaze, the mariner tries to turn his eyes to heaven to pray, but fails. It is only in the moonlight, after enduring the horror of being the only one alive among the dead men, that the mariner notices beautiful water snakes swimming beside the ship. At this moment, he becomes inspired, and he has a spiritual realization that all of God's creatures are beautiful and must be treated with respect and reverence. With his realization, he is finally able to pray, and the albatross falls from his neck and sinks into the ocean. Now, the mariner falls into a kind of stupor. He's kind of asleep. And then he awakes up to find the dead sailors' bodies reanimated. So they come back. They're zombies by angels, and they are at work on the ship. So you can imagine you fall asleep with all these dead men, and you wake up, and there's these zombies around you. Powered by the spirit from the South Pole, the ship races homeward, where the mariner sees a choir of angels leave the bodies of the deceased sailors. After this angel's chorus, the mariner perceives a small boat on which a pilot and a pilot's boy and a hermit approach. So a little boat with three men on it. A pilot boy, and a hermit. As they get closer, the mariner's ship suddenly sinks, but he wakes to find himself in the pilot's boat, so he survives, of course. When the mariner speaks, the pilot and hermit are stunned by fear. The hermit prays. The mariner, in turn, saves his own saviors and rows them to land, where he begs the hermit to grant him absolution for his sin. The hermit crosses himself and asks the mariner, "What manner of man art thou?" That's an important question in the story. What manner of man art thou? What manner of man are you? The mariner then feels compelled to tell his story. Now, the compelling thing I want to emphasize is not he feels compelled as in it'd be nice to tell the story. It's like he has to tell the story or he's going to burst type thing. Like he's got to tell it. The mariner concluded his tale by explaining that as he travels from land to land, he concludes his tale, to the wedding guest by explaining that as he travels from land to land, he's plagued by the same compulsion that he has to tell the story. It's not a feeling that it'd be nice to tell the story. It's like, I'm going to die and blow up. My head will explode from within if I don't tell this tale. And he experiences a peculiar agony if he doesn't give in to his urge to share the story. And that he can tell just from looking at their faces. So he looks around and it's like this one person has a glow to them. And that's the person the mariner has to tell a story to. He ends the whole poem with the explicit lesson that prayer is the greatest joy in life. And that the best prayers come from love and reverence of all of God's creation. So this is kind of the wisdom and the lesson that he's telling to the wedding guest and that he's going from land to land telling to people. At least that's what he's saying. Whether that's actually it, that's another question. Now, he moves onward. So he finally lets the wedding guest go and to find the next person who must hear the story. Leaving the wedding guest, he calls himself a sadder and wiser man. Okay, so that's a basic summary of it. That's what's going on. Now, if you need a break, take a break. But I'm going to next read the poem and I'll give you a little musical break here. But I'm going to read it. Like I said, it's a little bit long. Or you can skip it and just pay attention. If you want to skip it and go to the ending, I'll put some timestamps in the at troubadourmag.com so you can go listen to Ian McKellen's much better version reading of it. Or if you want to listen to it, great. There's going to be a musical little interlude here. And then I will go into the reading and then we'll do a little wrap-up conclusion about the origin and the influence of this great poem and a little bit of the meaning. Although this is a poem that would take forever to go through the meaning of it, of everything. So I kind of want you to explore on your own a little bit. Okay, so here we go. Thank you. can easily believe that there are more invisible creatures in the universe than visible ones. But who will tell us what family each belongs to, what their ranks and relationships are, and what their respective distinguishing characteristics may be? What do they do? Where do they live? Human wit has always circled around a knowledge of these things without ever attaining it. But I do not doubt that it is beneficial sometimes to contemplate in the mind, as in a picture, the image of a grander and better world. For if the mind grows used to the trivia of daily life, it may dwindle too much and decline altogether into worthless thoughts. Meanwhile, however, we must be on the watch for the truth, keeping a sense of proportion so that we can tell what is certain from what is uncertain, and day from night. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. An ancient mariner meeteth three gallants bidden to a wedding feast, and detaineth one. Part 1. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. By thy long gray beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stoppest thou me? The bridegroom's doors are opened wide, and I am next of kin. The guests are met, the feast is set, mayst hear the merry din. He holds him with his skinny hand. There was a ship, quoth he. Hold off, unhand me, graybeard loon. Eftsoons his hand dropped he. The wedding guest is spellbound by the eye of the old seafaring man, and constrained to hear his tale. He holds him with his glittering eye. The wedding guest stood still, and listens like a 3 years child. The mariner hath his will. The wedding guest sat on a stone. He cannot choose but hear. And thus spake on that ancient man, the bright-eyed mariner. The ship was cheered, the harbor cleared. Merrily did we drop below the kirk, below the hill, below the lighthouse top. The mariner tells how the ship sailed southward with a good wind and fair weather, till it reached the line. The sun came up upon the left, out of the sea came he, and he shone bright, and on the right went down into the sea. Higher and higher every day, till over the mast at noon, the wedding guest here beat his breast, for he heard the loud bassoon. The wedding guest heareth the bridal music, but the mariner continueth his tale. The bride hath paced into the hall, red as a rose is she. Nodding their heads, before her goes the merry minstrelsy. The wedding guest, he beat his breast, yet he cannot choose but hear. And thus spake on that ancient man, the bright-eyed mariner. The ship drawn by a storm toward the South Pole. And now the storm blast came, and he was tyrannous and strong. He struck with his o'ertaking wings, and chased us south along. With sloping masts and dipping prow, as who pursued with yell and blow still treads the shadow of his foe and forwards bends his head, the ship drove fast. Loud roared the blast, and southward, aye, we fled. And now there came both mist and snow, and it grew wondrous cold, and ice, mast high, came floating by, as green as emerald. The land of ice and of fearful sounds, where no living thing was to be seen. And through the drifts, the snowy cliffs did send a dismal sheen. Nor shapes of men, nor beasts we ken, the ice was all between. The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled, and roared and howled, like noises in a swound. Till a great seabird, called the albatross, came through the snow fog, and was received with great joy and hospitality. At length did cross an albatross. Through the fog it came. As if it had been a Christian soul, we hailed it in God's name. It ate the food it ne'er had ate, and round it flew. The ice did split with a thunder fit. The helmsman steered us through. And lo, the albatross proveth a bird of good omen, and followeth the ship as if it returned northward through the fog and floating ice. And a good south wind sprung up behind. The albatross did follow, and every day, for food or play, came to the mariner's hollow. In mist or cloud, on mast or shroud, it perched for vespers nine. While all the night, through fog smoke white, glimmered the white moonshine. The ancient mariner inhospitably killeth the pious bird of good omen. God save thee, ancient mariner, from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why look'st thou so? With my crossbow, I shot the albatross. Part 2. The sun now rose upon the right. Out of the sea came he, still hid in mist, and on the left went down into the sea. And the good south wind still blew behind, but no sweet bird did follow, nor any day for food or play came to the mariner's hollo. His shipmates cry out against the ancient mariner for killing the bird of good luck. And I had done a hellish thing, and it would work 'em woe. For all averred, I had killed the bird that made the breeze to blow. Ah, wretch, said they, the bird to slay that made the breeze to blow. But when the fog cleared off, they justify the same and thus make themselves accomplices in the crime. Nor dim nor red, like God's own head, the glorious sun uprist. Then all averred, I had killed the bird that brought the fog and mist. 'Twas right, said they, such birds to slay that bring the fog and mist. The fair breeze continues, the ship enters the Pacific Ocean and sails northward even till it reaches the line. The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. The ship hath been suddenly becalmed. Down dropped the breeze, the sails dropped down. 'Twas sad as sad could be, and we did speak only to break the silence of the sea. All in a hot and copper sky, the bloody sun at noon, right up above the mast did stand, no bigger than the moon. Day after day, day after day. We stuck, nor breath, nor motion. As idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean. And the albatross begins to be avenged. Water, water everywhere. And all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere. Nor any drop to drink. The very deep did rot. O Christ, that ever this should be. Yea, slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea. About, about, in reel and rout, the death fires danced at night. The water, like a witch's oils, burnt green and blue and white. A spirit had followed them, one of the invisible inhabitants of this planet, neither departed souls nor angels, concerning whom the learned Jew, Josephus, and the Platonic Constantinopolitan, Michael Psellus, may be consulted. They are very numerous, and there is no climate or element without one or more. And some in dreams assured were of the spirit that plagued us so. 9 fathom deep he had followed us from the land of mist and snow. And every tongue, through utter drought, was withered at the root. We could not speak, nor more than if we had been choked with soot. The shipmates, in their sore distress, would fain throw the whole guilt on the ancient mariner, in sign whereof they hang the dead seabird around his neck. Ah, well-a-day, what evil looks had I from old and young? Instead of the cross, the albatross about my neck was hung. Part 3. There passed a weary time. Each throat was parched and glazed each eye. A weary time. A weary time. How glazed each weary eye. When looking westward, I beheld a something in the sky. The ancient mariner beholdeth a sign in the element afar off. At first it seemed a little speck, and then it seemed a mist. It moved and moved, and took at last a certain shape, I wist. A speck, a mist, a shape, I wist. And still it neared and neared, as if it dodged a water sprite. It plunged and tacked and veered. At its approach, it seemeth him to be a ship, and at a dear ransom he freeth his speech from the bonds of thirst. With throats unslaked, with black lips baked, we could nor laugh nor wail. Through utter drought, all dumb we stood. I bit my arm, I sucked the blood, and cried, "A sail! A sail!" A flash of joy. With throats unslaked, with black lips baked, agape they heard me call. "Gramercy!" they for joy did grin. And all at once their breath drew in, as they were drinking all. And horror follows, for can it be a ship that comes onward without wind or tide? "See, see," I cried, "she tacks no more, hither to work us weal. Without a breeze, without a tide, she studies with upright keel." The western wave was all aflame. The day was well nigh done. Almost upon the western wave, rested the broad, bright sun, when that strange shape drove suddenly betwixt us and the sun. It seemed to him but the skeleton of a ship. And straight the sun was flucked with bars. Heaven's mother send us grace! As if through a dungeon grate he peered with broad and burning face. Alas, thought I, and my heart beat loud, how fast she nears and nears. Are those her sails and glance on the sun, like restless gossameres? And its ribs are seen as bars on the face of the setting sun, the specter woman and her deathmate, and no other on board the skeleton ship. Are those her ribs through which the sun did peer as through a grate? And is that woman all her crew? Is that a death? And are there two? Is death that woman's mate? Like vessel, like crew? Her lips were red, her looks were free, her locks were yellow as gold. The skin was as white as leprosy. The nightmare life in death was she, who thicks man's blood with cold. Death and life in death have diced for the ship's crew, and she, the latter, winneth the Ancient Mariner. The naked hulk alongside came, and the twain were casting dice. The game is done. I've won. I've won, quoth she, and whistles thrice. No twilight within the courts of the sun. The sun's rim dips. The stars rush out. At one stride comes the dark, with far-heard whisper o'er the sea. Off shot the spectre bark. At the rising of the moon, we listened and looked sideways up, fear at my heart as at a cup my lifeblood seemed to sip. The stars were dim and thick the night. The steersman's face by his lamp gleamed white. From the sails the dew did drip, till clomb above the eastern bar the horned moon with one bright star within the nether tip. One after another. One after one by the star-dogged moon, too quick for groan or sigh, each turned his face with a ghastly pang and cursed me with his eye. His shipmates drop down dead. 4 times 50 living men, and I heard nor sigh nor groan. With heavy thump, a lifeless lump, they dropped down one by one. But life and death begins her work on the Ancient Mariner. The souls did from their bodies fly. They fled to bliss or woe. And every soul, it passed me by, like the whiz of my crossbow. The wedding guest feareth that a spirit is talking to him. Part 4. I fear the Ancient Mariner. I fear thy skinny hand. And thou art long and lank and brown, as is the ribbed sea sand. I fear thee and thy glittering eye, and thy skinny hand so brown. Fear not, thou wedding guest, this body dropped not down. But the Ancient Mariner assureth him of his bodily life, and proceedeth to relate his horrible penance. Alone, alone, all alone. Alone on a wide, wide sea. And never a saint took pity on my soul in agony. He despiseth the creatures of the calm. The many men so beautiful, and they all dead did lie. And a thousand thousand slimy things lived on, and so did I. And envieth that they should live, and so many lie dead. I looked upon the rotting sea, and drew my eyes away. I looked upon the rotting deck, and there the dead men lay. I looked to heaven and tried to pray, but or ever a prayer had gushed, a wicked whisper came and made my heart as dry as dust. I closed my lids and kept them closed, and the balls like pulses beat, for the sky and the sea and the sea and the sky lay like a load on my weary eye, and the dead were at my feet. But the curse liveth for him in the eye of the dead men. The cold sweat melted from their limbs, nor rot nor reek did they. The look with which they looked on me had never passed away. An orphan's curse would drag to hell a spirit from on high. But oh, more horrible than that is the curse in a dead man's eye. 7 days, 7 nights, I saw that curse, and yet I could not die. In his loneliness and fixedness, he yearneth towards the journeying moon and the stars that still sojourn yet still move onward, and everywhere the blue sky belongs to them and is their appointed rest, and their native country and their own natural homes, which they enter unannounced, lords that are certainly expected, and yet there is a silent joy at their arrival. The moving moon went up the sky, and nowhere did abide. Softly she was going up, and a star or two beside. Her beams bemocked the sultry main, like April hoarfrost spread. But where the ship's huge shadow lay, the charmed water burnt away, and still an awful red. By the light of the moon he beholdeth God's creatures of the great realm. Beyond the shadow of the ship, I watched the water snakes. They moved in tracks of shining white, and when they reared, the elfish light fell off in hoary flakes. Within the shadow of the ship, I watched their rich attire. Blue, glossy green, and velvet black, they coiled and warm, and every track was a flash of golden fire. Their beauty and their happiness. Oh, happy living things, no tongue their beauty might declare. A spring of love gushed from my heart, and I blessed them unaware. Sure my kind saint took pity on me, and I blessed them unaware. He blessed them in his heart. The spell begins to break. The selfsame moment I could pray, and from my neck so free, the albatross fell off and sank like lead into the sea. Part 5. Oh, sleep, it is a gentle thing, beloved from pole to pole. To Mary Queen, the praise be given, she sent the gentle sleep from heaven that slid into my soul. By grace of the Holy Mother, the ancient mariner is refreshed with rain. The silly buckets on the deck that had so long remained. I dreamt that they were filled with dew, and when I awoke, it rained. My lips were wet, my throat was cold, my garments all were dank. Sure, I had drunken in my dreams, and still my body drank. I moved, and could not feel my limbs. I was so light, almost I thought that I had died in sleep, and was a blessed ghost. He heard sounds and sees strange sights and commotions in the sky and the element. And soon I heard a roaring wind. It did not come anear. But with its sound it shook the sails that were so thin and sere. The upper air burst into life, and 100 fireflies sheen. To and fro they were hurried about, and to and fro, and in and out, the wan stars danced between. And the coming wind did roar more loud, and the sails did sigh like sedge, and the rain poured down from one black cloud. The moon was at its edge. The thick black cloud was cleft, and still the moon was at its side. Like water shot from some high crag, the lightning fell with never a jag, a river steep and wide. The bodies of the ship's crew are inspired, and the ship moves on. The loud wind never reached the ship, yet now the ship moved on. Beneath the lightning and the moon, the dead men gave a groan. They groaned. They stirred. They all uprose. Nor spake, nor moved their eyes. It had been strange, even in a dream, to have seen those dead men rise. The helmsman steered. The ship moved on. Yet never a breeze up blew. The mariners all again worked the ropes, where they were wont to do. They raised their limbs like lifeless tools. We were a ghastly crew. The body of my brother's son stood by me, knee to knee. The body and I pulled at one rope, but he said not to me. But not by the souls of the men, nor by the demons of earth or middle air, but by a blessed troop of angelic spirits sent down by the invocation of the guardian saint. I fear thee, ancient mariner. Be calm, thou wedding guest. 'Twas not these souls that fled in pain, which to their courses came again, but a troop of spirits blessed. For when it dawned, they dropped their arms and clustered round the mast. Sweet sounds rose slowly through their mouths and hymned their bodies past. Around, around flew each sweet sound, then darted into the sun. Slowly the sounds came back again, now mixed, now one by one. Sometimes a dropping from the sky, I heard the skylark sing. Sometimes all little birds that are, how they seem to fill the sea and air with their sweet jargoning. And now 'twas like all instruments, now like a lonely flute. And now it is an angel's song that makes the heavens be mute. It ceased, yet still the sails made on a pleasant noise till noon. A noise like of a hidden brook in the leafy month of June, that to the sleeping woods all night singeth a quiet tune. Till noon we quietly sailed on. Yet never a breeze did breathe. Slowly and smoothly went the ship, moved onward from beneath. The lonesome spirit from the South Pole carries on the ship as far as the line, in obedience to the angelic troop, but still requireth vengeance. Under the keel 9 fathom deep, from the land of mist and snow, the spirit slid, and it was he that made the ship to go. The sails at noon let off their tune, and the ship stood still also. The sun, right up above the mast, had fixed her to the ocean, but in a minute she gained stir with a short uneasy motion, backwards and forwards, half her length with a short uneasy motion. Then, like a pawing horse let go, she made a sudden bound. It flung the blood into my head, and I fell down in a swound. The polar spirit's fellow demons, the invisible inhabitants of the element, take part in his wrong, and two of them relate, one to the other, that penance long and heavy for the ancient mariner hath been accorded to the polar spirit who returneth southward. How long in that same fit I lay, I have not to declare. But ere my living life returned, I heard, and in my soul discerned, two voices in the air. "Is it he?" quoth one. "Is this the man? By whom Didon cross, with his cruel bow he laid full low, the harmless albatross. The spirit who biddeth by himself, in the land of mist and snow. He loved the bird that loved the man who shot him with his bow." The other was a softer voice, as soft as honeydew. Quoth he, "The man hath penance done, and penance more will do." Part 6. First Voice. "But tell me, speak again, thy soft response renewing. What makes that ship drive on so fast? What is the ocean doing?" Second Voice. "Still as a slave before his lord, the ocean hath no blast. His great bright eye, most silently, up to the moon is cast. If he may know which way to go, for she guides him smooth or grim, see, brother, see, how graciously she looketh down on him." First Voice. "The mariner hath been cast into a trance, for the angelic power causeth the vessel to drive northward faster than human life could endure. But why drives on that ship so fast, without a wave or wind?" Second Voice. "The air is cut away before, and closes from behind. Fly, brother, fly, more high, or we shall be belated, for slow and slow that ship will go, when the mariner's trance is abated. The supernatural motion is retarded, the mariner awakes, and his penance begins anew. I awoke, and we were sailing on, as in a gentle weather. 'Twas night, calm night. The moon was high. The dead men stood together. All stood together on the deck, for a channel dungeon fitter. All fixed on me their stony eyes, that in the moon did glitter. The pang, the curse, with which they died, had never passed away. I could not draw my eyes from theirs, nor turn them up to pray." The curse is finally expiated. "And now this spell was snapped. Once more I viewed the ocean green, and looked far forth, yet little saw of what had else been seen. Like one, that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread, and having once turned round walks on, and turns no more his head. Because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him dread. But soon there breathed a wind on me, nor sound nor motion made. Its path was not upon the sea, in ripple or in shade. It raised my hair, it fanned my cheek like a meadow gale of spring. It mingled strangely with my fears, yet it felt like a welcoming. Swiftly, swiftly flew the ship, yet she sailed softly too. Sweetly, sweetly blew the breeze, on my alone it blew. And the ancient mariner beholdeth his native country. Oh, dream of joy! Is this indeed the lighthouse top I see? Is this the hill? Is this the kirk? Is this mine own country? We drifted o'er the harbor bar, and I with sobs did pray. Oh, let me be awake, my God, or let me sleep alway. The harbor bay was clear as glass, so smoothly it was strewn. And on the bay the moonlight lay, and the shadow of the moon. The rock shone bright, the kirk no less, that stands above the rock. The moonlight steeped in silentness, the steady weathercock. And the bay was white and silent light, till rising from the same. Full many shapes that shadows were, in crimson colors came. The angelic spirits leave the dead bodies and appear in their own form of light. And little distance from the prow, those crimson shadows were, I turned my eyes upon the deck. O Christ, what saw I there? Each corpse lay flat, lifeless and flat. And by the holy rood, a man all light, a seraph man, on every corpse there stood. This seraph band, each waved his hand. It was a heavenly sight. They stood as signals to the land, each one a lovely light. This seraph band, each waved his hand. No voice did they impart. No voice, but oh, the silence sank like music on my heart. But soon I heard the dash of oars. I heard the pilot's cheer. My head was turned perforce away, and I saw a boat appear. The pilot and the pilot's boy, I heard them coming fast. Dear Lord in heaven, 'twas a joy. The dead men could not blast. I saw a third. I heard his voice. It is the hermit good. He singeth loud his godly hymns that he makes in the wood. He'll shrieve my soul. He'll wash away the albatross's blood. Part 7. The Hermit of the Wood. This hermit good lives in that wood, which slopes down to the sea. How loudly his sweet voice he rears. He loves to talk with mariners that comes from a far country. He kneels at morn and noon and eve. He hath a cushion plump. It is the moss that wholly hides the rotted old oak stump. The skiff boat neared. I heard them talk. Why, this is strange, I trow. Where are those lights so many and fair, that signal made but now? Approacheth the ship with wonder. Strange, by my faith, the hermit said, and they answered not our cheer. The planks looked warped, and see those sails? how thin they are and sear? I never saw aught like to them, unless perchance it were brown skeletons of leaves that lag my forest brook along. When the ivy tod is heavy with snow, an owlet whoops to the wolf below that eats the she-wolf's young. Dear Lord, it hath a fiendish look. The pilot made reply, I am afeard. Push on, push on, said the hermit cheerily. The boat came closer to the ship, but I nor spake nor stirred. The boat came close beneath the ship, and straight a sound was heard. The ship suddenly sinketh. Under the water it rumbled on, still louder and more dread. It reached the ship, it split the bay, the ship went down like lead. The ancient mariner saved in the pilot's boat. Stunned by that loud and dreadful sound, which sky and ocean smote, like one that hath been 7 days drowned, my body lay afloat. But swift as dreams myself I found within the pilot's boat, upon the whirl where sank the ship, the boat spun round and round, and all was still, save that the hill was telling of the sound. I moved my lips, the pilot shrieked, and fell down in a fit. The holy hermit raised his eyes, and prayed where he did sit. I took the oars, the pilot boy, who now doth crazy go, laughed loud and long, and all the while his eyes went to and fro. Ha ha, quoth he, full plain I see, the devil knows how to row. And now, all in my own country, I stood on the firm land. The hermit stepped forth from the boat, and scarcely he could stand. The ancient mariner earnestly entreateth the hermit to shrieve him, and the penance of life falls on him. Oh, shrieve me, shrieve me, holy man. The hermit crossed his brow. Say quick, quoth he, I bid thee say, what manner of man art thou? Forthwith this frame of mine was wrenched with a woeful agony, which forced me to begin my tale, and then it left me free. And ever and anon, throughout his future life, an agony constraineth him to travel from land to land. Since then, at an uncertain hour, that agony returns. Until my ghastly tale is told, this heart within me burns. I pass, like night, from land to land. I have strange power of speech. That moment that his face I see, I know the man that must hear me. To him my tale I teach. What loud uproar bursts from the door? The wedding guests are here. But in the garden bower the bride and bridemaid singing are. And hark, the little vesper bell, which biddeth me to prayer. O wedding guest, this soul hath been alone on a wide, wide sea. So lonely 'twas that God himself scarce seemed there to be. O sweeter than the marriage feast, 'tis sweeter far to me to walk together to the kirk with a goodly company. To walk together to the kirk and all together pray, while each to his great father bends, old men and babes and loving friends, and youths and maidens gay. And to teach by his own example love and reverence to all things that God made and loveth. Farewell, farewell, but this I tell to thee, thou wedding guest. He prayeth well, who loveth well both man and bird and beast. He prayeth best who loveth best all things both great and small. For the dear God who loveth us, he made and loveth all. The mariner, whose eye is bright, whose beard with age is hoar, is gone, and now the wedding guest turned from the bridegroom's door. He went like one that hath been stunned and is of sense forlorn. A sadder and wiser man, he rose the morrow morn. Trying to understand what's happening here. You know, I read that introduction at the beginning of the poem. So when you, after the musical interlude, there's a little description that Coleridge added to his final printing of this, where he talks about, I can easily believe that there are more invisible creatures in the universe than visible ones, but you can't tell what class they belong to. So his view is that there are these kind of creatures that exist in the world. And this has been an ancient view for a long time. You know, there's creatures in the deep sea. There's angels all over the place. Or there's gods of the lakes and trees and dryads. And, you know, all these kinds of creatures that we can't see. And they're invisible to us unless they want us to see them. And they're littered around literature, for instance. You know, they help Achilles and Paris and Patroclus and people, you know, they're all over the Iliad and the Aeneid and all the ancient epics and poems and stories. They're all over the place. And they're believed, you know, Hercules did all these great feats and he was, you know, he played around with these invisible creatures, the gods, Zeus came. So there's this kind of tradition that there are these invisible creatures. Of course, the age of medievalism and Gothicism, or Christianity, excuse me, had a view that there was just one God and there are angels, was another common thing, or just one God. And, you know, so all these creatures didn't exist. And in the Age of Reason, which the Romanticists are kind of rebelling against, the world has turned into this mathematical equation that leaves no room for the imagination. And he's making a case for the imagination. Now, it's not a coincidence that this is the first poem published in the 1798 Lyrical Ballads with Wordsworth and Coleridge, which launches English Romanticism. And it really fosters and speaks for a lot of what Romanticism means in its essence. So there's a lot in this poem particularly, and in the book Lyrical Ballads in general, that really resonated with the romantics of this era, and that I think gave rise to a lot of the romanticism that we know of today. I mean, the idea of using the imagination to create a new sacramental universe. And then this is one of the questions that many of these romantics were asking themselves is, can we create a new sacramental universe that has our own view of, you know, the power of the imagination, the power of the individual, and create an actual religion around that rather than the religion that we've been sullied with that leads to death and misery and oppression and, you know, the killing of innocent people. And that's what I think they're really going for. Where can imagination take mankind? Now, of course, it can create for us a heaven on earth, the wonders of all the universe at our feet. Or, of course, we do learn it can create for us a hell on earth, misery and misfortune laid out before our eyes. Now, this poem is one of the first religious, I think it's, from what I've read, the first religious poem to give us a mystery with no hint to the broader supernatural world. So, you know, there is no grand plan as you get in Milton or Dante, you know, like God's plan. There are no manipulative gods leading to a destiny of Rome, as in Virgil. And they aren't, you know, there's no petty scheming gods, as in Homer. There is this mysterious, terrifying event of the killing of of getting lost in the South Pole and the killing of this albatross. But there is no source for the effect. We can tell that it's a kind of religious skepticism. So it's saying that, well, there are religious effects out there. There are supernatural things. We just don't know where they come from. And this is still a dominant idea today. And this is why I think romanticists have profound impact, both good and bad, in our own culture. I know a lot of people who call themselves atheists, but they still believe in supernatural things, oddly enough. Now, another way of understanding this whole thing is, and this poem, is that it presents, the poem presents us with a series of related effects ordered within themselves, the causes of which remain unknown, and the ultimate cause unknowable. So, in other words, Kantianism by a different route, for those of you, philosophy nerds like me. So I'm not going to go into what Kantianism is, but what you need to understand if you don't, you know, care about is that there are these causes, but the causes, you know, what is the albatross mean or doing to them? Why did he kill that albatross? And why did the death and life and death gamble? Like, that's a kind of a causeless thing. It's a gamble. And, you know, why did all the other mariners die, the sailors die, and he lived? What caused that? I mean, he's the one who killed the albatross. Was that the good thing? I mean, there seems to be these causeless things in the universe or in the story of this universe. And that, and those causeless things, they remain pretty much mysterious and unknown. And the ultimate cause is unknowable. I think that's important, is that there's not really a way to know what's going on with with that cause or with this idea. Now, so I think, you know, when you look through the poem, you can kind of ask yourself the meaning of certain things. You know, he bites his arm, and, you know, so there's obviously and he sucks the blood, right? And there's obviously a relationship to Christianity. So the romantics, unfortunately, were not great philosophers, and they're trying to build a religion, but the only framework they have is Christianity, so they're basically just building it on that framework, right? So there's a fall and a redemption. And just like the fall and the redemption in Christian cycle, there's not really a reason for it. I mean, he just does it. It's impulsive. He sees the albatross and he wants to kill it. We don't know why. There's something in there. Now, of course, metaphorically, you could say it's just the fall of man. And that, I think, is what you get in the Christian Bible of Adam and Eve eating the apple of the from the tree of good the knowledge of good and evil, is they just do. Now, there's a serpent that, of course, tells Eve to do it and so on. But I think essentially they just eat the apple, right? Even though there's no real reason to do it because they're perfectly taken care of. Now, I want to talk about a little bit of the impact of this poem and what it did for people. First, actually, let me go into a little bit of the origin of it, because it's an interesting origin. It's the origin of lyrical ballads itself. Is this poem leads to lyrical ballads. So what was going on was the Coleridge and the Wordsworth, Dorothy and William, were kind of going on a tour, a walking tour. And they were at this place, the Valley of the Rocks, and running parallel to the coast, it's this narrow, streamless valley. It cowers under ramparts of bare rock. By the way, I'm going to read a little bit from A Life by Wordsworth, A Life by Juliet Barker. And I'll provide a link in TroubadourMag.com. But it's a streamless valley. It cowers under ramparts of bare rock, the very bones and skeletons of the earth, as a friend described it to Wordsworth and Coleridge. Rock reclining upon rock, stone piled upon stone, a huge and terrific mass, much beloved then as now by those of Gothic sensibilities. The desolation of the valley of rocks has inspired many an artist, and our poets were no exception. It was they decided, the perfect setting for a description of the wanderings of Cain, from Cain and Abel, of course. Coleridge threw down a challenge. Now, by the way, if you know anything about Romanticism, you know this is not the history of Romanticism. This is not the first nor last challenge that was thrown down that led to some great works of art. So if you're an artist, maybe take that as a challenge. You know, get together with some friends and throw down some kind of challenge. But here is the challenge. They would each write a canto, and whoever finished first would write the final canto. The whole project was to be completed that night. It was a foregone conclusion. Now, it was a foregone conclusion what would happen with this. Now, this Travelings of Cain is published by Coleridge in his stories. I have read it. It's kind of interesting. But that's actually not what led. That story didn't directly lead to the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, but it did reveal something important about their young sensibilities and what they were, you know, what they would create. So here's what Coleridge wrote 30 years later. Methinks I see his grand and noble, by the way, I'm sorry, he's talking about Wordsworth. So, and the challenge. So he challenged Wordsworth to this canto writing of the wanderings of Cain. Methinks I see his grand and noble countenance, as at the moment when, having dispatched my own portion of the task at full finger speed, I hastened to him with my manuscript. That look of humorous despondency fixed on his almost blank sheet of paper, and then in silent mock piteous admission of failure, struggling with the sense of the exceeding ridiculousness of the whole scheme, which broke up in a laugh, and The Ancient Mariner was written instead. So they basically came to the conclusion, why are we writing about Cain? Right? Like, why? This isn't what we want to be writing about. They want to be writing about a new mythology. They want to create a new mythology. And that's something, you know, it's Romanticists are not just about propagating and continuing exactly the mythology of the past, but of putting their own unique spin on it based on their own inner world. And that's what they did. So they laid out a plan of a ballad to be published with some of Williams. And their object was purely financial at first, but this is the original idea. They had a friend, by the way, named John Cruikshank, I believe. And he had dreamt of a mariner, or he had dreamt of a skeletal ship, I should say, with figures on it. So it comes from a dream. Now, this is a very common romantic idea. Many poems, novels, short stories, musical compositions came out of dreams. Paintings, lots and lots of paintings. There's a painting called The Nightmare, and it's supposed to have come from a nightmare. And it's like this woman, she's lying down, she's asleep, and there's this imp, this evil little imp on her chest. And then there's this mare. And I believe this is the origins of the term nightmare. I could be wrong. But and there's this mare, this horse that's kind of evil looking in, and that's the nightmare. And so there's you know, and that was inspired by a nightmare from the artist. And there's a whole I think it's Fuseli. Henry Fuseli is the artist, if I'm remembering correctly. Someone correct me if I'm wrong. But so there's this whole idea that the dream, and the reason this was important for romantics is because it came from the self. So dreams were very important to the romantics because it's the subconscious imaginings of their own imaginings and their own unique processes that they found most important, not just reiterating what everybody said before them for thousands of years. They wanted originality. Now, there are some other origins, and Wordsworth had a lot of influence on this poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So he read, for instance, a similar story of what was going on with the skeleton ship from a book called A Voyage Round the World by the Way of the Great South Sea. So William suggested that killing an albatross should be the mariner's crime. So William suggested, one, that there should be a crime, and two, that it should be killing an albatross, and that three, the mariner's crime, and that there should be revenge sought by these spirits of the South Sea. And then finally, he put forward the idea of the dead men being reanimated to navigate the ship. Now, having said that, Coleridge is the one who actually wrote down most of the words. I believe that Wordsworth only contributed about 10 lines of this, you know, pretty long poem. And in a kind of casual, almost accidental way of this, you know, roundabout working on this poem together, they decided to work on a series of a book together, a book of poetry, and that was born Lyrical Ballad. So that's the origins of Lyrical Ballads. Now, I do want to say a little bit of the influence of this poem, and then we'll kind of wrap up here. So this, the words, and the reason Lyrical Ballads is written and published the way that it is that they wanted to have these two kind of manner of affecting the language. And I've been reading Metaphysical Mondays. I've been reading poets from the Metaphysical Poets, and from, I want to do some Cavalier Poets, and I've been doing some ballads. So I want you to get a sense for how the 1700s and 1600s and 1500s was vastly different in their use of metaphor. Metaphysical poets were famous, for instance, like John Donne, for their grand metaphors that were so grand they didn't really connect to reality at all. But they invented their own kind of world of random metaphor, their own kind of isolated language, which the Romantics did not want to do. And the Romantics, particularly Wordsworth and Coleridge, wanted to be men speaking to men. They wanted to have the language of the common man used in their poetry. Now you may think, well, hey, wait a minute. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is not the language of normal men, is it? And yes, that was the exception. And the exception was, what they were trying to do was, in Lyrical Ballads, was used, so almost all the poems in Lyrical Ballads are using the language of men, ordinary men, especially the Wordsworth poems that you can go to troubadourmag.com, and I've been going through the whole series, and I'll be putting together a whole blog post of the whole book, Lyrical Ballads. But what they are trying to accomplish, I believe, with this is that it's at one time a continuation of all of our previous exploits and progress. So thousands of years of development of the language, and we're developing this, and look, this ancient story of the Ancient Mariner, which is, you know, it has the feel of this story that could have been told 700 or 1,000 years, or in ancient Greece. It could have been the ancient Greeks telling this story. It has that kind of feel that's ancient to it, right? The ancient rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. So maybe this mariner's been doing this for thousands of years. We don't know. And so there's that connection to the past. but we're going to be using the English language as it is used by the everyday man. And so there's a connection to the past as it's connected to the present. And that's one of the ways that they tried to make that connection. Now, that's why the Ancient Mariner sounds a little bit different, because it is very much different. And in a sense, there are multiple streams, if not two predominant streams in Romanticism. There is the kind of focus on the exploits of heroic, ordinary men that you get in Wordsworth, and you get in some of Tennyson, and you get especially in Hugo. A lot of he has great heroic men, and they're very original, but they are men, right? They're not fantastical creatures. And so there is another stream, which are the fantastical creatures like the Frankenstein. So Frankenstein, Dracula, these are all romantic figures coming out of the Romantic era. And you're getting this kind of dual aspect to Romanticism, is these new imaginary creatures, and then a whole new approach to creating heroic men, which you see also with Wordsworth at the beginning. Now, just one thing, or a last thing, I think, on the influence is I wanted to finish by talking about Frankenstein. So I talked about how Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, heard this poem and hid behind a chair because she resonated so much with her and it really affected her. Well, it really did affect her, because when she was challenged by her husband and Lord Byron in a famous, I believe it was 1817, and I believe she published this, maybe it was 1818, and I think she published in 1819. I may be getting the date slightly wrong. When she was a 19-year-old girl, recently married to Percy Shelley, the famous romantic poet, and they threw down a challenge to write a horror story. And she was profoundly impacted by this horror story, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And so she wrote about a man who comes to tell a tale to a mariner. So this man comes to this man, Victor Frankenstein, has a moral lesson to teach, and he teaches it in the form of a conversation, essentially. And it's all framed in epistolary manner. Now there is a kind of framework in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner that's similar. So it starts off with the mariner, it starts off with the narrative of us at a wedding, and then the mariner telling a story, so it's embedded of a story. And then it ends with us, and it's even interrupted by the narrator, the overall narrator of the poem, telling us that the wedding guest is freaked out, for instance, at a certain point, because he thinks that perhaps the Ancient Mariner is a ghost. So the framework of both is somewhat similar, and she was inspired by The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And the whole idea of telling a tale in order to impose a lesson, a moral, to somebody else is, something, of course, that's common in Christianity, but it was not common in the way, in the unique way of, telling these moral tales like, in the way that it is in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, where it's a man compelled to tell this story in a supernatural way. And Victor Frankenstein has that kind of, connection. Now, there are other connections between these two poems. And the Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge is, of course, also expostulating a certain idea of why morality, or how morality is spread and what morality should be. And then more, I think probably the most important thing is the idea of a transgression. So the mariner transgresses when he kills the albatross. And in Frankenstein, in fact, Mary Shelley included a passage where Robert Walton, the navigator, the captain of the ship, writes a letter to his sister and says, "Do not worry, I will kill no albatross." Now, of course, what Mary Shelley is indicating is that in this world of men, they are transgressing certain things without even knowing it. It's built into the structure of their story. Victor Frankenstein does it. Robert Walton does it. And the way that they transgress is that they try to use scientific knowledge to move beyond the bounds of what men should be able to do. So Robert Walton himself is transgressing, and Victor Frankenstein has to save him, in a sense, by telling him his story. Robert Walton is transgressing by going after Hyperborea. That's what he's trying to achieve. He's trying to find Hyperborea, which is this, you know, the magical place that if you go north enough, you go to the absolute pole, essentially, you're going to find this magical Eden area. It's going to be all green and lush and beautiful and perfect. And there's going to be magical creatures, and it's this land of godlike. It's, you know, what the gods spoke of. That's where Robert Walton is going after, is the land of Hyperborea. Well, that's not a land for men. That's not a land for humans. Stay in your lane, in a sense. And Victor Frankenstein is doing the same thing. He's trying to animate life. Well, that's what women are supposed to do. That's what women do. That's women's job. And it's not a coincidence that it is the sisters and the lover, you know, the wife of these two men who kind of act as foils to their moral ambitiousness. They're trying for too much. Ambition can be good, but this is too much. You're going too far. That's it. Too much. Stay back. Come home. Be with us. That's going to Hyperborea is not a good thing. Reanimating the dead is not a good thing. Let women animate the, you know, dead flesh. That's what we do. And they transgressed. So this is, you know, from a woman of Mary Shelley, a woman who lost a child. This is her kind of tale about these kind of using science for this transgression. And at this time, we were not sure that, you know, they were not sure that science couldn't do that. And, you know, now in 2019, science probably can do that, especially if we were to unshackle it. So there's an idea that science can transgress certain moral conundrums that this would cause calamity. So there's a lot of similarities, and they've been very influential, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, on Mary Shelley. And she did something, again, original. So she was inspired. This idea of being inspired and your imagination being stirred is important to the Romantics. And she was inspired by this story to tell her own story. And that's, you know, that's what she accomplished. And she told her of her own kind of the transgression she saw that men didn't seem to be particularly aware of, and that they were going to create this Frankenstein monster. Okay, so that is The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and a little bit of a discussion of its meaning and influence. By the way, there's also I'll include a little link in this too. Why not? An Iron Maiden song. So it's very influential in so many ways. There's a lot of Gothic influence. The Gothicism, which I didn't get into, and it would take another, you know, long, you know, tirade to go into. But Gothicism is also included in this poem. And I'll just say that one of the things that was so interesting to Romantics, starting with Goethe and even people before Goethe, was the idea of this grand structures, like these castles, these grand castles, but they were deteriorating. They were crumbling. They were falling apart. And in the 1700s, when you were getting the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Romantic Revolution, you were getting this revolution that was changing everything, where all of a sudden the king was not really a king. He was just a man like everybody else, right? Where the rights of man were being written, where just ordinary proletariats, the peasants of the streets, were demanding that they were equal in rights to kings and queens. And so it was a complete topsy-turvy world all of a sudden. I mean, thousands of years of structural development were just crumbling. And so, of course, there was a kind of kinship and a relationship to these Gothic medieval structures that were crumbling all around them. So you had Christianity, which used to be the dominant figure, but now it's crumbling behind science and progress and, you know, fraternity and brotherhood or whatever they wanted to call it at that time. So that had a very big impact on the Romantics. You know, you have the Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole, which was one of the first ones to call something a Gothic tale. And the Gothics, by the way, were, you know, what they mean by Gothic is the Goths, the Visigoths that conquered Rome in 476 AD, the barbarians that sacked Rome and took over. So this is the structure, you know, when we think of the Dark Ages that happened shortly after, or we can even count it with, you know, around 480 or, you know, 500 AD, around that time to, you know, like the Renaissance in the 12, 1300s. That's the era of what we might think of as the Goths. Of course, each of the different, you know, areas and regions in Europe broke apart and they became their own independent entities. This is the birth of, you know, the France and German or Prussians. And they each kind of had their own little identity. But the point is that there were these grand medieval structures developed during this time, and they were all powerful, you know, in a sense. And yet now in the 1700s, by the 1800s, they're falling apart. And so that idea that there's a structure that's falling apart was very intriguing to the Romantics, because the question is, what would replace it? So in a lot of these horror stories, you get that kind of feeling. And one of the famous American ones is the Fall of the House of Usher, which is exactly that kind of story. It's a Gothic story brought to America, where you have this structure that was controlling everything for forever, but now it's falling apart. And what causes that? And so that is something they were interested in. And that is in the Rime of the Ancient Mariner as well, as this Gothicism. You know, there's a new type of, there's a fall, there's a horror, there's these spirits we're not, you know, familiar with. And, you know, yet we have to, you know, live in this universe. And so that's what the role of the imagination is understanding that. Okay. So I hope that you found this interesting. I know it was long, but I hope that the length will, you know, you'll put in the work to try to understand a little bit more about what's happening in poems like The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Thank you.